Funding for the Think podcast comes from TCU, exploring renewable and sustainable energy sources to power a clean energy future. Stories of research can be found at endeavors.tcu.edu. Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. When is quitting a good thing? Of course, we're quick to applaud when somebody kicks a nicotine habit or takes control of a drinking problem, but we tend to be more ambivalent about walking away from long-held occupations, relationships, and dreams. Our culture celebrates persistence against the odds, while the word quitter is used almost exclusively as an insult. But as my guest today will tell us, the ability to strategically quit what is unlikely to ever succeed can be enormously energizing and can clear a path for learning, growth, and new goals. Alan Bernstein is a licensed clinical social worker and has served on the faculty at New York Medical College and New York University's doctoral program in psychotherapy. His new book, written with co-author Peg Streep, is called Mastering the Art of Quitting: Why It Matters in Life, Love, and Work. He joins us from the studios of NPR in very cold New York City. Alan, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much.
You call quitting a necessary first step, and yet so many people think of quitting as an ending rather than a beginning.
Well, I would use quitting in the way that you're phrasing it. I would call it goal disengagement as the first part of it, meaning that you have to have the ability to disengage from a path that you're on currently in order to feel that you have a way forward in life. And for many people, that's a very difficult step because there are so many unconscious elements in our personality which keep us persisting in spite of whatever evidence there may be that this is not going to work out. And a lot of that, as I said, is unconscious. And therefore, until we start thinking of it as an option, it's going to be very hard for us to actually take the road of quitting without feeling guilty, irresponsible, losers, all the negatives that you mentioned in your introduction.
And so often, I guess, we just feel like we have invested so much in whatever we need to quit that just a little more effort might finally get us to the place we need to be.
That's well put. I mean, there are a number of fallacies involved in that reductionist view of quitting. For example, you probably heard of the sunk cost fallacy. Mm-hmm. Economists use that term for people, for example, with thinking where they should buy some more stock. But most of us in life, I just had this discussion with my wife last week. We just put $2,500 into a 10-year-old Honda. And the question is, was that a good use of the sunk cost fallacy? In other words, was that really the last good money we'll have to sink into a car that will last us for years? Or was it the beginning of a drain that made no sense? And the truth is, you know, in that situation, we really don't know how to predict that. We'll find out going forward, but obviously, if it's a relationship or a career, it's a much more powerful and wide-ranging decision. But it takes place usually outside our consciousness. Basically, people are very, very reluctant to acknowledge that they're about to take a huge loss. And so the sunk cost fallacy has a tremendous support system within the personality.
What makes our culture value persistence to the extent that it does?
Well, there's a lot of cultural myths, as you know, I'm sure you've heard. I mean, Rocky is probably the apex of a culture which defines itself as people who lose until they win. Mm-hmm. And in our culture, the notion of people persisting is a very powerful idea. And as I said, there are a number of other fallacies which support that. I mean, we have the near-win situation. For example, gamblers, we have a place in Connecticut for the weekend, and when you go to the slot machines, you see people getting excited. And they've actually done a study where people will get, you know, in the slot machines, you have those three different boxes, and people get cherries in two of them, and the third one is almost at the line with the third cherry's almost there. And when they do the research on their brain scans, people are actually excited as if they were really nearly winning. But the truth is it's computer generated. They're no more near winning than if they had cherries and blueberries. Hmm. But the excitation, you know, the sense that you're getting closer to actually winning something is very powerful.
And of course, we have, you know, when we talk about the mythology of persistence, I mean, we have songs about dreaming the impossible dream. There are no songs about like a well thought out, manageable goal that we can achieve with the hard work, you know.
That's quite funny. It's true, and you know, there are also tantalizing elements in our culture as well. For example, there's a psychological term in research called the availability heuristic, which is basically a fancy word for talking about how easily drawn in we are to advertising. For example, if I were to ask you, are you more likely to be killed by a piece of falling plane shrapnel or a shark, which one would you answer?
It seems like a shark would be the thing because they seem so dangerous.
Exactly. And yet you're 30 times more likely to be killed by a piece of falling airplane shrapnel. But the truth is, when people are killed by a piece of falling airplane parts, nobody writes about it. Nobody cares. But when somebody gets bitten by a shark or eaten by a shark, it's all over the airwaves and the newspapers. And so the availability heuristic also promotes the idea that, you know, I'm doing okay. It makes you more optimistic about the possibility of this thing working out, whatever this thing is.
So sometimes we're reluctant to quit because whatever it is we are a part of, whatever we're doing, has become central to our identity, and we may not be certain that we can find anything better. Talk about how that idea of disengagement plays into the ability to sort of push past that.
Well, we know that we're giving something up. We know we're losing something. That's part of the sunk cost fallacy. We have to acknowledge a loss. And people, you know, to put it in a fancy term, people are loss averse. They can't stand the idea they've actually committed themselves to losing something. So in order to even begin the process of reframing where you're going, you need to work in the direction of writing down what's going to replace what you're giving up. Otherwise, you get stuck in what we call a ruminative position, which is a kind of endless loop of negativity. And to help people move forward in that, I've worked with a concept originally put forward by Dr. Chechen Mihai in a book called Flow, which was written about 20 years ago. But it's a brilliant piece of work. And basically, he organizes people around the idea that when they are in a process of working or thinking or doing in which they lose all track of time, the chances are that they're working in a way which has their interests, they're working in the style which they love, and they're meeting whatever their individual motivations are being met at every level in this activity. So I usually start people out with the idea that we're going to find out what they're like when they're in a state of flow. And we work out from that to potentially naming careers or relationships or whatever direction they're headed in that they want to change, which come closer to meeting those flow needs. Another way of defining them is separating what are called extrinsic rewards versus intrinsic. In our society, of course, extrinsic rewards are all over the place. What's your title? How much money do you make? Where do you live? But those really are not as significant for long-term satisfaction as intrinsic rewards. In other words, that the job you're doing or the person you're with or the life that you're leading is somehow synchronized in a large sense with who you are as a person, that you're meeting some kind of intrinsic sense of what you were meant to do in this world.
It seems that many people, I mean, I feel very fortunate to really love my work, but I meet a lot of smart, hardworking people who don't, who maybe feel like the perfect job doesn't exist for them.
Well, I mean, the perfect job takes a lot of work to identify the parts of yourself that are that must be met for you to feel like it's, quotes, the perfect job. I myself started my career as an academic. And so did Peg, by the way. We both were taking PhDs in English literature. We both quit somewhere in our dissertation. And the reason I quit is that I realized that academic work was really defined by being a good researcher, which I had no interest in, and that I didn't know the title of the career which I wanted, which was psychotherapy. And I had to go back, and I had to make the decision, first of all, that the 4 years I had spent taking my PhD program in English literature and passing the orals, I had to swallow the idea that I had lost that time. But I was so impressed by the experience and the idea of psychotherapy that I felt it was worth it. So you have to, first of all, have the confidence that you're moving forward into something that feels good for you. One of the ways you do that, of course, is talk to people who are doing what you might want to do so that you have a feeling of what the career is actually like before you enter into it. Many people simply, you know, go by an idea of what their career is, and then they don't know what to do when they find they're disappointed by it.
So, Alan, given the undeniable allure of those extrinsic rewards that you mm-hmm. described, talk about some effective ways to assess whether what we are doing might, in fact, be leading us down a path that doesn't make us happy and doesn't make us the best people we can be.
So are you asking what will help propel us into balancing and looking at a potential other career for ourselves? Is that?
Well, I guess I'm asking, does everybody know if they ought to quit? Or are there people who have no idea that maybe they would be better off if they tried something new?
Well, there are some specific things I ask people to look out for. For example, if they find that their lives have become very compressed, that they're only doing what they're prescribed to do, that there's nothing in their work life or their romantic life or their life feels fresh or vital or interesting to them. Basically, if there's a kind of low-grade depression, then that's a very good sign that you probably should be rethinking how you're leading your life. The question then becomes, you know, what do you do to make the quitting experience work for you rather than against you? In other words, if you're just thinking about maybe I should quit, the chance of you getting stuck in the ruminative cycle are pretty strong. If you want to quit, you have to commit yourself to a process, which is a really deep evaluation of how close does this current career I'm in, you know, meet my needs. And then what are you going to do to start looking for a new career? Because the only way to move forward when you're stuck in an incomplete quitting cycle is to develop new goals for yourself. Otherwise, you're almost certainly going to be stuck in the swamp of rumination. And, you know, new goals are not easy things to develop. In fact, some people really need external support for that. Going to your friends and talking to them about your interests, if you're really stuck, can be a very, very useful way to start your way forward.
I guess you have to choose those people carefully, though, because won't there be people who will say, my God, what are you doing quitting this job? You've done this, this, and this. I mean, do you have to choose wisely who you reveal these ideas to?
Yes, you do. You have to choose people who are going to have, that you're confident will have your best interests at heart. But I think that's a powerful way forward. That's not, of course, the only way forward. I also recommend that people do the flow exercise that I talked about, where you write down experiences in your life when you've lost all track of time. And, of course, you know, like other people in the field, I'm a skilled therapist in helping people navigate these particular waters. But the issue for people who are not sure about quitting is that they don't make good interviews when they start going out. I had someone I practiced a couple of years ago who was a lawyer who was quite unhappy at being a lawyer, and he wanted to start thinking about going to the other side, the business side. And usually you start by talking to people, but each time he talked to people, it didn't go any further. And I had him go over the conversation with me, and what he kept telling people, in effect, was, I'm so sorry I went to law school. I've ruined my life before it even began.
Hmm.
And, of course, what happened is that nobody was promoting him as a potential candidate for any other career.
Let me jump in here. My guest is Alan Bernstein. We're talking about his new book, Mastering the Art of Quitting, Why It Matters in Life, Love, and Work. We'll be back in about 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with licensed clinical social worker Alan Bernstein, who has served on the faculty at New York Medical College and New York University's doctoral program in psychotherapy. His new book, written with co-author Peg Streep, is called Mastering the Art of Quitting: Why It Matters in Life, Love, and Work. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So let's talk more about this gentleman that you were working with that you said was ready to leave law but maybe had not fully let go of his old of the time he had spent as a lawyer and the time he had invested, the work he had invested in that education.
Yeah, I mean, basically, unconsciously, what he was looking for until we talked about it was both a combination of permission and maybe a pat on the shoulder about the error that he'd made, which, of course, is not anybody's interest in giving to him if he wants to promote himself in a new career. And once he got a hold of that, he stopped leaking in that direction, stopped leaking his sense of sorrow and failure and started presenting himself as a resource. All the skills that he had mastered, which were considerable, he's a very bright guy, but at the moment which I first met him, he hadn't resolved yet that really what he wanted to do was quit and that it was a respectable decision. He was still suffering from the idea that somehow he had made a terrible error and that his life in his late 20s was over before it even began.
So we can go through this exercise of understanding what it feels like to be in a state of flow. What else mm-hmm. do we need to do to get ourselves ready to begin the process of quitting? Because walking in and saying, I'm out of here, is just a tiny little thing, and there's really so much more
right.
to it.
Yeah. When we talk about quitting, we're not talking about slamming the door and saying, screw you. We're talking about a reasoned acknowledgement that the road you've traveled for whatever reason is not the road you want to be on. And at that point, you begin the process of goal setting for yourself. You're looking for specific goals to lead to a higher performance. These goals have to be meetable. You have to be able to select goals that make sense for you, and you have to have the ability to achieve it. And there must be no conflicting goal. In other words, the goal has to be one that you can commit yourself to. You know, in business, they say if you want to start a new division or a new product, you want a pessimist to make the choice whether to engage with the new product or the new business, and then you want an optimist to promote it. The pessimist makes better decisions. Optimists, on the whole, are biased in the direction of thinking they can do anything if they want to. Whereas pessimists actually are better at making decisions based on previous history. And then you want an optimist to push it through. But once you've set your goal, you want to be able to frame it as a challenge to lead to higher performance. We advocate instead of, and this is based on research, instead of telling yourself, I will do this, you start from the premise of, will I do this? Which most people experience as a broader, more interesting way of framing a challenge. Will I opens up a much larger thought pattern than I will. Of course, once you decide on a goal, then I will becomes a useful way of stating it, because that brings out the optimistic, powerful impulse.
Well, you stress the importance here of framing goals correctly. What do you mean by mm-hmm. that?
Well, the you can't have goals that are in your life that are in conflict with each other. We use in the book, for example, an example of a couple who sort of live together. They live in different states. And he is a spender, and she is worried about retirement. But anytime she thinks about that I can't live with his spending habits because we're going to be broke by the time we retire, she realizes that she also can't stand the idea of living alone without him. So she can't really proceed. They can't really decide whether they want to stay together or leave each other because the goals are are in conflict. And goals of that sort that are working against each other can't be united. They can't be unified in a way which allows people to move forward in a way. So you want your goals to be in sync. You want to smooth them out in such a way that you can move forward on them, and that you can actually do what we call goal mapping, where you can actually talk about the possible steps forward. And in doing so, you not only optimistically think about the straight line that will get you to where you want to go, but you also think about what are the possible failures that you can meet along the way, and how will you deal with them? Because no path like that is going to be a straight line. It's going to be zigging and zagging. And the more you're prepared for what we call mental contrasting, seeing what's going to work out positively for you versus what's going to work out negatively for you, the more likely you are to keep moving.
So there is quitting by one's own agency, and then there is the detachment that has to happen after one is sort of unintentionally quit. You're fired mm-hmm. from a job. You're left by a
right.
partner. In strange ways, they require some of the same work, but there's additional emotional baggage when you didn't make the decision yourself.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, the steps may be the same, which is the you start out with a sense of denial. You know, it's not really happening. And then usually it's engaged with some form of blaming and anger, if only, I wish I had. And then there's usually some depressive mood before you can go into an active phase. And these are not necessarily distinct, you know, steps. They can coexist. But if the decision is taken out of your hands, if you're dumped by a boss or by a lover, each of the stages become that much more powerful and intense, no question about it. Certainly the sense of depressive review of who you are and how did you get to this place is much more intense if the decision wasn't made by you, no question.
You warn that the single-minded pursuit of goals can cause us to see whatever progress we're making outside of the proper context. Can you explain what you mean by that and why it might be so problematic?
I'm not sure I understand the question. So,
well, if we're sort of looking at our goals in a single-minded way,
mm-hmm.
We may not recognize other things that are happening in our lives that may not be good. So in other words, if all we can focus on ever is meeting a goal, there may be other areas of our lives, I would imagine, that aren't being fulfilled.
So, as I understand what you're asking, if you have an synchronized sense of your life. In other words, if your life is all about your career or all about your relationship, and if that changes, you tend to be really bereft in a way that people with more harmonious lives aren't. So you're looking to balance out your life, that you're trying to create a life which has some harmony in it. And, some of that, you know, of course, is the kind of life you're looking at before you either get dumped by a lover or fired by a boss. You're looking at a sense of balance in your life. You're looking at a feeling that your life has more than one dimension to it. And, you know, people whose life is constricted around one version of themselves are really deeply hampered if they lose something like that. I mean, but one of the ways that people can pick up after a loss of that sort, let's say you have a death of a spouse and you're widowed or a widower. I mean, one of the things I've noted for people is to imagine what the meaning of that person or that experience was in their lives and to take a meta position to it, meta being spelled M-E-T-A. In other words, to consider what that person or what that career meant in their lives and to try to organize themselves around a version of the meaning. For example, if your spouse was the keeper or the giver of a sense of intimacy in your life and a sense of belonging in a social sense, you may not be getting married again. It may not happen. And you may want to find and organize yourself around other aspects of the community where you can have some of the same feelings of belonging to a community in your church or your synagogue or your as a person who works for the common good, where the feelings of being part of an intimate organization, an intimate community, can stay with you. And what you're doing is assessing from the outside what it would be like to have some of the same feelings you had in your relationship or in your job, and to recreate them outside so that you're not totally bereft of the experience.
Can you talk about our fear of failure and how that might play into our path towards something new or our reluctance to leave something that's not working in the present?
So our fear of failure, of course, is in large part it's an opportunity, really, to reassess our sense of ourselves. And if we're somewhat precarious in our sense of self-confidence and we lose something essential to our lives as a job or a career, we're in a very precarious sense about our sense of ourselves. Who are we? What am I now that I don't have a title? A few years ago, I wrote a book about retirement when people actually retired before 2008. And one of the things I had noted was that when people lost their career titles, many people in major roles in organizations as executives, usually there was a frequency far above what you'd expect for them to die within a couple of years of retiring. And I think part of the reason for that is that they had lost a sense of purpose. And so one of the things we advocate in the whole notion of quitting is being clear about what your sense of purpose is going forward, so that you haven't abandoned your sense of yourself. You've been given, and you've given yourself, an opportunity to recreate it and to do it in a way that's closer to the essential you.
And it may not be something, we may not create the same kind of meaning in the next job. It might be that we find this in a hobby or an avocation. Is that accurate?
Yeah. I mean, in other words, what you're looking to do is to find that kernel of you. What is your basic motivation? For some people, it can be competitive. I'm smarter than the next guy. I'm richer than the next guy. For some people, it may be more communal. I make the world a better place. Without me, I feel that this community would suffer greatly. Or even on a more familial, narrower note, my children would not survive without me. So that people find and create meaning for themselves.
What do you recommend to people who feel like they need to make a major change, but they are surrounded by perhaps loved ones, perhaps a spouse who vehemently disagrees? I'm sure there are people who get sort of trapped in these places.
I'm sure there are. And I think the first thing to do is respectfully start a discussion about what the source of your desire or your need to consider quitting is. That considering quitting isn't necessarily the same thing as quitting. And then you have to bring them along on your thought process. What is it that you're trying to do? What is it that you're trying to achieve? How are you going to try to achieve it? If you're going to go back to school, how will you afford that? How can they help? How can they contribute to it? And these are important decisions to bring a spouse or a family member alongside with you. In effect, you're creating for them a value proposal, and you want them to discuss with you whether the value proposal makes sense. Is it real? And remember, people tend to be optimistic. The bias is towards optimism in these situations. So you're actually doing yourself a favor by having some pessimistic questioning of, is the value proposal working for you? Is it real? And having people develop arguments about what ifs and how can we and what will happen if. These are actually valuable parts of goal mapping and the direction you want to go. We don't advocate it as a unilateral, single, screw you, I'm doing what I want. It's a process.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Travis on the line in Denton. Hey, Travis.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I wanted to ask about the situation that arises when you lose something by achieving it. Specifically, I graduated college, and I lost my identity as a student, and I was kind of at a loss with what to do. It probably didn't help that I studied philosophy and existentialism, but I just wanted to know how the whole relationship of loss works when you achieve something and you lose it.
Thanks so much for your call.
That's a wonderful example. I mean, basically, you were in the position of being quit on. In other words, basically, your student status was taken away from you. So you're in the first phase of what we talk about, which is you're in the now what phase. What are you going to do? How are you going to go forward? And we find that when people actually write down their goals and create goals that they commit themselves to, not in the I will, but in the will I stage, that they're much more likely to explore and discover than if they just think about it and ruminate about the process, and which is, it sounds like, where you are at this point. You have a sense of having lost something without knowing what's waiting for you to gain at the other end. And then once you start to develop some sense of where you want to go, I would begin the process of interviewing people who are doing things like what you might want to do. I mean, I don't know many existentialist philosophers in the Dallas area, but I'm sure that they exist, and I'm sure they'd be happy to talk with you.
We're speaking this hour with Alan Bernstein. He's a licensed clinical social worker who has served on the faculty at New York Medical College and NYU's doctoral program in psychotherapy. He's co-author, along with Peg Streep, of a new book called Mastering the Art of Quitting, Why It Matters in Life, Love, and Work. We'll come back to this discussion in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org. You can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd, Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is licensed clinical social worker Alan Bernstein, co-author along with Peg Streep of the new book Mastering the Art of Quitting, Why It Matters in Life, Love, and Work. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We have an email here from Pat asking about switching careers to a job that she's more passionate about. She writes, "How can I move forward from the place I'm in? I can't quit until I have a place to go, but I'm not sure how to get to that place."
Well, as we've talked about, one of the ways that you want to move forward is to get more information about potential careers where you can use the skills that you really favor. In other words, most of the time we're in a job that we don't particularly like. There are parts of it we do like and parts we don't. Your job is to be able to select the parts that you really do like and that you're particularly skilled at, and then see if you can parlay that into your next career. And the way you want to do that is to convert yourself from someone who's looking for a job, what we call a job beggar, into someone who's creating themselves a resource so that you can go to a company, for example, where you've done some research and say that, you know, I've noted that you don't have someone in this particular position. Those fit perfectly with my skills. I'd love the opportunity to be able to do this kind of work for you. Our recommendation is to convert yourself and to take the time to do it from someone who's merely looking for a job, because it's like shooting craps. You don't know what you're going to end up with. into someone who actually creates the position that you're looking for based on your self-knowledge and your ability to influence the person who can hire you.
How about with relationships? Because it seems that all of us in a relationship, when things aren't going well, we usually assume that the problem is the other person. And sometimes that may be right. Sometimes that may be the case, but there may be times when we have to sort of turn around and take a hard look at ourselves. Can you give us some insight on that?
Well, when I work with a couple, for example, I literally have them train each other to be able to listen better. I may have them sit on the couch and synchronize their breathing and hold hands and look at each other and have the first person talk and say emotionally what's going on for themselves. No accusation, no blaming, just a statement of, I'm feeling this right now. And I wait until there's a pause, and then the other spouse gets a chance to repeat back what they have heard. No judgment, no blame, no defensiveness or retaliation. Just a demonstration that they have registered emotionally what their partner is saying. And I find it's a very powerful exercise, and I try to train people to use it at home with each other as well. Because if you don't have a feeling that the other person is going to affirm what you're feeling and at least listen to it, you get into a feeling of both rage and hopelessness at the same time, and it's quite a toxic mix.
What do you say to people struggling with things that they cannot quit? In other words, people may find parenting or caring for an elderly parent a struggle, but they are obligated morally to continue doing these things.
Mm. Well, it's obviously a very difficult situation. I mean, we're not advocating. This is not a book about happiness. This
right.
is a book about finding the parts of your life that are worth expanding and noting and making yourself clear about so that you can enhance them, and perhaps giving up the parts of your life that are really making you feel dead inside. I mean, if you're caretaking a parent and you somehow do it out of obligation in a way where you're just giving up your own life, you may have to consider hiring somebody for part of the time or finding some other solutions. This is not an easy fix. I mean, it requires cognitive change. In other words, you have to do a careful assessment. It requires effective change. In other words, you have to decide what feelings you can tolerate. Can you tolerate the bad sibling feeling or the bad child feeling? And you have to go through an assortment of a repertoire, really, of choices in order to arrive at something that can be balanced for you.
You explained in the book, Alan, that some people are sort of naturally more adept at quitting well than others. And for some who struggle with it, there's this great need to avoid any feelings of regret. We need to understand that there will likely be some regret no matter how positive a quitting experience is.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. As I mentioned, when I left academia, I wouldn't say that there was no regret. There was. I had put a few years into it, and there are parts of my career which worked extremely well for me. It's just on the whole, the balance of it didn't seem right to me. You know, there was work done in the 50s by Skinner, Dr. Skinner up at Harvard. Mm-hmm. He was a behaviorist, and he had a famous rat experiment. He had three rats, and the first rat was hitting the arm of the machine, which released a pellet. Every time the rat put his foot on this little arm of the machine, a pellet would come down, and he'd be one happy rat. And the second rat, every time he hit the same arm of the lever, no pellet would come. And this was, you know, a mildly unhappy rat, but he did what rats did in laboratories and, you know, spun in the rat wheel and, you know, had a good time in the sawdust. But the third rat, sometimes when he hit the arm of the lever, a pellet came forward, and sometimes it didn't. And he imagined he had more control over that, and we knew that because this rat would literally sleep next to the arm of the machine that sometimes gave him food and sometimes didn't, imagining that he had more control over the outcome than he did. And I think that, you know, I'm not a behaviorist, but I think that it's important for people to understand that they can't control the whole process. They can move themselves in a direction, and they can create goals for themselves, but they're constantly in the business of fine-tuning and reimagining how they're going to do it so that they can get to the place they want to get to.
And goals often, you know, we think of, you know, eyes on the prize and you know, we absolutely want to picture the end. But sometimes it might be helpful to look at the process goals and the small steps along the way that we're taking.
Mm-hmm. Well, we talk about that. We have a chapter in the book on goal mapping. In other words, that people who engage in what we call mental contrasting, in other words, they look at the possible ways forward, how much of it is going to be positive, what are the negative potential outcomes, what will I do if I hit those kind of roadblocks. Those people tend to be much more successful at getting to where they want to go because they're not being buoyed along by the optimistic bias that, you know, I will get there, I will do this. They are in the will I challenge stage. You know, when we're moving along, if we try to suppress our thoughts, there was a famous experiment, you may have heard of it, the white bear experiment, where people were told not to think of white bears. And they measured their thought process and were given questionnaires after. People who were told not to think of white bears ended up thinking of white bears twice as often as people who were not given any directive around it. So that if we're told not to feel bad about what we were supposed to do, not to think negatively about what we've given up, not to regret, we can get stuck in that paradoxically in exactly the kind of place we're trying to leave. It becomes that much more alluring and that much more powerful for us.
We have an email here from Meg in Dallas who writes, "My husband is a former infantry officer, a veteran of the Iraq War. He left the service to pursue his MBA and has been quite successful since. The sense of purpose you mentioned, however, is what he lacks in his life now and is searching for his next position with this single goal in mind, even considering re-entering the service. But what he's never articulated is exactly what that sense of purpose is. Beyond the brotherhood and other aspects of that experience, is this sense of purpose something in particular or just a general sense?" And I don't know the extent to which you can answer that, Alan, not knowing Meg's husband, but maybe you can speak to the question.
I can speak to the question. I can answer in terms of the specifics that she's given us, which is that he had, I imagine, based on what she's saying, a band of brothers experience in the service. I myself have not been in the service, but I spent a good deal of time working with Outward Bound and developing programs for them. And what you develop, the kind of comradeship and intimacy and a sense of mutual dependence in situations where you're relying on other people for your life, is a very powerful force. And he may find, having left that kind of experience and gone into the corporate world where, you know, interdependence is very transient, sometimes even, nebulous, almost unfelt experience, that he finds that he lacks and misses the intensity of mutual dependence. So what I would do if I was him would be to follow. We have a chapter in the book where people can really refine what their goals are, because it doesn't sound like he's clarified and created a language to explain the goals. And if what he's looking for is a kind of intense, involved community effort that is looking for something more intrinsic than extrinsic, in other words, that he's looking for an experience where people are united in a common goal and are willing to, you know, in effect die for it, then he might be much better off in a not-for-profit organization where people are committing themselves for some value other than, let's say, a paycheck, that they are committing themselves to an idea or a cause. And I would imagine for him, that might come closer to the experience he had as a soldier. Or, you know, there's no horrible thing about going back into the military and, you know, finding some experience there that's like the one that he's given up. I mean, military is a fine organization.
We have an email here from Susie in Fort Worth who asks, is there a way to teach children it's okay to quit while teaching them not to give up?
That's a very well-phrased question. We had a caller when I was on an NPR show last week who asked a very similar question. In other words, he had gone to his father and said that he had run cross-country and wasn't sure whether he wanted to continue since he wasn't enjoying it. And he said his father gave him an answer which stayed with him through his whole life. He said, have you given it 100%? And the son, who was a child at that point, now was a full-grown man, said, yes, I have. And the father said, well, then you're open to quitting. So I would recommend that a parent have that discussion with a child. Have you given it 100%? Have you committed yourself to this process, and do you find it wanting for some reason? And if that's the case, then the child has the right to discuss quitting, even if they have to, in effect, talk you through the steps.
You say that ultimately the people who are most satisfied with their lives are those who have the ability to persist and also have the ability to quit.
That's true. I believe that the people who allow themselves to keep reimagining their lives and keep measuring whether the life they're leading now is the life they want to lead and keep reinvigorating their opportunity going into the future tend to lead happier, more successful lives from the intrinsic state, that is, from the sense of who we really are as people. It's a very powerful opportunity that we give them in the book to imagine their lives being free of some of the things or some parts of it which are not feeding them now that may have in the past. But in order to do that, what we argue in the book is that you need to be able to create goals and create goals that are synchronous with the rest of your life and to be able to do it in such a way that you feel both optimistic about the future and yet can assess in a realistic mental contrasting way as to how likely it is that you're going to be successful going forward.
Is there a time limit on this? Are people able to still keep quitting and reinventing themselves even beyond midlife and into older age?
I would say, looking at my career, about every 10 years or so, I developed some new aspect. I started out as a therapist working with individuals, as a trained psychoanalyst. Then I went and developed the work of working with couples and families. I went to Ackerman Family Institute. And then following that, I got interested in careers. I worked with the Princeton Review to develop a program for people getting out of college who had no way of accessing who they were. They only knew what skills they could sell based on their record in college. And I think that people have an obligation to themselves to reassess their career and to lead the life they want to lead.
The new book by Alan Bernstein and Peg Streep is called Mastering the Art of Quitting, Why It Matters in Life, Love, and Work. Alan, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Chris, it was my pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think and contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.